Thank you, Ursula. All right, we've been doing it now. Time's flying by. Felix is filling in for Tom. And last week, Mike Lewis had trouble with the horses. Now, there's a wagon that we use to spread news and opinion. Our opinion is often referred to as manure. It's kind of a manure wagon. And, here comes Felix now on the wagon. Oh, hey there, Felix. You have no trouble getting the horses all ready to go, huh?
Yeah. Come on.
Hey, who's the guy without a shirt on sitting next to you?
Oh, that's Chuck. But you probably know him better as Charlton Heston.
Really did it.
Right.
He's shirtless.
You maniac! You blew it up!
Yes.
Damn you!
Seems upset.
Damn you!
Yeah, you know, horses are hard to manage sometimes.
You know, the show is so weird. That when Dory, who never listens to our show.
Who's that?
Dory. Because he's always doing his show, getting ready for our show. He's preparing. He's doing prep while our show's on the air.
He rehearses a full three-hour version of his show from 9 to noon. He rehearses everything he's going to say anyway.
Right. So he had never heard, like, the beginning of one of our segments. And he sat on hold, and we came to him. He seemed stunned. You throw this ball. Danny knows. I'll tell you something. I didn't get a chance to watch the Seahawks yesterday, and I knew Felix was my co-host. I thought, oh, crap. And then Jacob sends this thing at 5 in the morning saying the first two segments of the show are going to be Seahawks talk and Huskies talk. And that is going to be dreadful. Quick, hurry up and get Danny in here.
So I'm here.
Yes.
Did I come in on the horse?
No, you don't come in on the horse.
Dang it. What do I write here?
You just come in on your own.
How about a shirt? Do I have a shirt on?
I hope so.
You do have a shirt on. All right, so what do we learn from the game in London?
I like to categorize games. I'm trying to come up with a taxonomy of sporting results.
Okay.
Yesterday was a parade. That's what it was. It was a parade. It's one of these games where there's no suspense. Mm-hmm. And the only drama is you getting there on time. And then it comes by and you get to see all the different things you like. You're like, oh, there's Frank Clark. Frank Clark's so awesome. He had 2.5 sacks. He's so, oh, look, there's Rashad Penny. He was our first round pick. And, oh, he looked pretty good on that 24-yard catch. And little Russell Wilson. He's so cute. He was awesome, too.
So all they do is parade by.
That's exactly right. It's just a big, long celebration of how great the Seahawks were and how god-awful the Oakland Raiders were.
So do we, other than the fact that they are coming by with everything except for the McDonald's All-Star Band, did we learn anything else about the Seahawks? Hold on, Mr. Dan. Sorry about that.
I'm going to get that whip out again.
Get out of here. Okay, do we learn anything else?
Yes, we learned that the Seahawks are not a bad team.
Okay.
And that comes not just from yesterday's game, but through the first six games, four of which they played on the road. They're 3-3. They're not bad. I don't know if they're good and are going to make the playoffs, but they're not a bad team, and that's significant because when the season started with all the players that they lost from last year, there were a lot of people who thought this team is going to be bad. They're going to lose 11, 12 games. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a high draft pick. They're rebuilding.
Right.
They're not bad. They're better than that, and they're going to be as significant. They've got a chance to make the playoffs, and they've got a chance to be pretty good. They've improved even over the six games we've seen, and I think they've got a shot to be a good team, and we know they are not among the quarter of the league that's bad. Just, ugh.
So were we preparing ourselves for a bad season? So we're trying to get out ahead of the disappointment back in August and September?
Yeah, that's what we like to do, to gird yourself, to lean into the pain as it's coming. And I didn't think they were going to be bad, but I knew it was on the table.
Yeah.
I thought, and especially after the first two games where I was like, that offense looks awful. That they looked horrible offensively the first couple games. And their defense was playing okay, but nobody expects it to be great. Their offense should have been better, and you know what? Their offense has gotten better.
He takes the snap, looks right, steps up, fires inside, touchdown! Seahawks! Ball is caught by Jerome Brown, 5 yards deep in the end zone, and the Seahawks get on the Wembley Stadium scoreboard first.
I'll tell you something, that sounded like a home game.
You know, it did, and I was disappointed because I never watched on TV. I only listened to the game on 97.3 Cairo FM or 710 Cairo AM because it's the home team, hometown, home station, all that stuff.
Good job,
I was hoping it was going to be on shortwave and really like coming in and out and like you'd lose it for 10 seconds during the sunspot.
London.
It sounded like Ed Murrow during an air raid in London, but no. It could have been from Quest Field. No, what's it called? CenturyLink. That's
yes,
right.
Instead, it was Wembley.
Yeah, but it didn't sound like it at all. I mean, in kind of a disappointing way, it sounded like a home game.
What kind of fan do you need to be to get on an airplane, fly all the way over there, and then get tickets and spend money in a hotel and eat in London?
Have a good time. That's a great trip. You don't think that'd be a fun place to go watch a football game?
I struggle enough driving from Sammamish to Seattle and looking for a $30 parking spot and then walking in the rain to the game.
I went to L.A.
Well, I'm parking in Tukwila.
I went to L.A. last weekend to watch the Huskies play, and that was like I was there for 24 hours. I went to Atlanta to watch a game. It's a really fun trip to arrange a quick weekend or even a longer time around.
How far would you go to watch the Cougs?
So week 7, complete chaos in college football. So you start to look at the drawing board where College game day should go for week 8, and there's really no debate. It's been a long time. 15-year anniversary is this Saturday for that beautiful flag, Old Crimson. It's been traveling around College game day. So there's only one place for College game day to go. Oregon at Washington State. We will see you in Pullman.
So they're coming to Pullman. Would you go? Have you ever attended one of these things as a cultural iconic sort of touch point to go to game day?
Sure. I've gone to Pullman and I've gone and seen game day when it was here at UW.
Yeah,
I've been here
too,
a couple times. Yeah. And how far would I go? I'll go to Ritzville. Because that's where I'm staying. I got my Friday night reservation. I'm going to Pullman. I'm going to root for the Cougs.
Wait, isn't Ritzville like 3 hours from Pullman?
It's like an hour and 50 minutes. I don't know if you're aware.
It's the only place you can get parking.
Yeah, Pullman doesn't have many hotels.
I go to Quincy usually. Yeah.
And they're kind of booked up right now, so that's as close as we could get.
Explain the significance of the flag that shows up at game day.
The Cougs have used, in their infinite mastery of technology, have used the mail service to send a flag around to make sure that some numbskull brings the flag to each and every game day site.
Uh-huh. It's the same flag. It's not just some Cougar flag that goes up every week.
You think the Cougars can afford multiple flags?
Wow.
No, there's one, and they have to put their kidney in hawk to be able to check it out and then go fly it from in front of it. And it's really, it's amazing. I mean, it's a dedication to two things, like a testament to two things, which is first, that they don't have anything better to do, and second, that they really love the Cougs.
Oh, and overnight delivery service, too, or two-day delivery really works in this country. Yeah.
They've been able to handle logistics. They're good with supply chain.
Why couldn't FedEx sponsor that?
Yeah, it's possible.
Perfect.
Yeah.
The other thing I think is remarkable, assuming that the person holding the flag is probably drinking copious amounts of alcohol, it's pretty good that they still are able to remember where the flag is at the end of the game in order to ship it on to the next game, don't you think?
Well, the bar's not that low. I mean, keeping track of a flag? I mean, let's not pretend that we're asking the guy, hey, could you please calculate the curve of a parabola? I mean, it's holding onto a piece of cloth.
It's tied to your wrist, probably, on a little...
All right, last thing. Huskies blow it, and then that's pretty much the end for them.
So painful.
So close.
That's the blunt force trauma game. If the Seahawks game was a parade, the Husky loss was blunt force trauma.
Okay.
And it's kind of the thing, when it's over, you question why you care about football. Why do I even care about this thing that brings me pain? Just abject pain. I actually, as the Oregon kid scored, it affected my vision. Like, things got cloudy on the periphery.
On the sides, yes.
And it was like, I was just like, ugh. It was blunt force trauma is what I felt.
Did you feel pain in your jaw, and was it radiating down your arm?
No, it was mostly just my vision, and things got kind of hazy on the outside, and then it was a head rush, I guess is what you would say. And then I was like, I have to turn the TV off, and I have to go out somewhere so I don't break anything right now, because I'm really angry and I'm too old to break things over sporting results.
Did you lose track of your flag?
Yes.
I felt bad for the kicker who missed that field goal. Wait, no, I know, but wait. The kicker, Peyton Henry, who missed that kick with 3 seconds left, but then kicked successfully in the overtime, he had that little few minutes of kind of redemption, but then that probably all went away with the touchdown.
Yes, it's tough. I feel really bad for him. Keep his head up. We're going to need him to make more kicks this year. Go Cougs. If the Cougs win, the Huskies have the control of their own destiny in the Pac-12 North. And then the Seahawks will be coming.
Apple guy.
Coming back to the bye. What? Bounce, bounce, I'm going to take my shirt off.
I try to keep those segments as short as possible.
I know the sport.
Stop talking.
Oh, come on.
When Danny says something, it seems slightly entertaining. Like that's a period in the end and an exclamation point. Bang, I hit the music. We're done. Right? Don't be coming in with like, did you lose your flag?
That was a good line. That was better than his line.
You know, we're going to talk about this in post.
He chuckled.
All right, here we go.
There was a chuckle.
Some guy asked me on Saturday, so at the end of the show, do you guys sort of sit down and kick it around to find out like what worked and what didn't? I said, no, Jacob goes out some side door, says goodbye to me, and Tom sort of shuffles off to his desk and then talks to Rachel Bell and Jason Rance about movies. There's no sort of talking about the show.
Military style after action review.
Call it. It's like using a toilet. You don't even look back. You just hit the flush and walk out and then feel bad that you didn't wash your hands.
Try again tomorrow.
Harvard has been on the hot seat for a couple of years now. A group of Asian students that felt like they were getting a short shift and not necessarily being allowed to get into Harvard, they brought a case against them. And Harvard said, I think it was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, we can't let anybody see how we admit students because this is our secret formula. Mm-hmm. And if we were to let other universities see how we choose, that would be a real problem to us. That would hurt us as an institution. And they used that sort of phony lie for long enough until finally, I think the Department of Justice also got involved. And now they will testify today in court how it is that they either discriminate or not discriminate against Asian students.
Yeah, there's this guy named Edward Blum, who's part of a group called Students for Fair Admissions. He's done this a few times in other states, trying to sue to force this whole notion of what colleges are using, how they're deciding who gets in. And I don't know if you've done this before, but I've spent a lot of time in the last 6 months with my daughter looking at colleges and looking at their admissions policies, looking at their acceptance rates. And it's all hidden. I mean, they say, oh, no, we don't look at your test score. Mm-hmm. We don't look at your grade point average. Oh, yeah, well your essay is important, but it's not everything. No one wants to say exactly what's included. Uh-huh. I said a great presentation a few weeks ago from an East Coast school that will remain nameless. And this guy mentioned all the criteria they go through, all these things that we would all know of. And he said, but then there's something else called institutional priorities. You know, whether the football coach might need a quarterback because the quarterback's a senior and he's going to graduate. Uh-huh. So we might need a quarterback. Or we might need somebody for our rowing team. And then someone raised their hand and said, when does the school publish that list of institutional priorities so we know what you're doing? And the guy said, no, that's secret. No, they don't say what their institutional priorities are. There's this whole set of secret institutional priorities they're using to fill these holes they need, irrespective of grade point average, test score, essay, you know, recommendations from your teachers or whatever. It's all a racket and a scam, and it's all very expensive, dude.
Well, most of these Ivy League schools in the 20s did what they could to stop Jews from getting in there, and they would cap that. And then this just seems like if you decided you were going to treat everybody exactly the same, and the Asian students are getting all A's and getting perfect SAT scores, and they've got all the stuff that they need to do, you would let them in, and you would have 45% of the population there at Harvard would be Asian. And then you say, well, this isn't a diverse student body. We want to be able to have a diverse student body. So we're going to have to discriminate against some people because we only have a certain number of spots. Mm-hmm. So even though you got all A's and did everything you're supposed to do, we're going to give you this personality test and you're not going to do as well as a minority student. So therefore you don't score as many points. And then we can use this personality test as a way of saying, well, that was one of the contributing factors to allow this person to come in. I hope Harvard gets their ass handed to them because these guys have a serious charge against them that they did everything they were supposed to do to get all the grades they're supposed to get, and they don't get the same credit for what their scores are compared to somebody else in order to have a diverse student body.
Yeah, because I think right now, in the most recent year for which numbers are available, 23% of those admitted to Harvard were Asian American, and that's Asian Americans only represent 6% of the general population.
Right.
So already the number is four times the general population. So you're saying that it should be completely colorblind or race-blind?
In California, state schools, when they got rid of this thing, and the number of Asian students rose. Now, the number of Asians living in California has also increased. But when they took the governor off, like an engine, all of a sudden they were able to rise to the number of people that could apply to the school and get in there. No, I just think it's unfair. You have some kid, say he's 8 years old or 12 years old, and he studies and he wants to do well, and his parents are pushing him, his grandparents are pushing him, and he's Asian and he wants to succeed and he wants to go to Harvard, and he applies himself. He doesn't spend a lot of time involved in anything else other than academics. He sends his application in there, and then they're like, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to give it to somebody else whose grades were not as good as you, who didn't dedicate as much time as you did, who didn't commit themselves the way you did, and we're going to let that person in because we want to have a diverse student body. By the way, when you get a diverse student body, you still have all the Asians sitting together, all the black kids sit together, all the white kids sit together, and then the Polish people. I can't think of any other. I just wanted to throw one more in there.
Thanks.
But everybody basically just sort of silos into their own group anyway. So this whole idea of having this diverse student body, do you really feel when you were in college that everybody was sort of all in this big melting pot?
I went to the University of Washington and I commuted. I was never there. I was just there for class and trying to find my car. So, I mean, do you think it should be different for a private school or a public school? Or is there, I mean, is there anything?
Because Harvard's
an elitist school. They only let, what, 2,000 kids in every year.
Right. You're allowed to discriminate because it's a private organization. Like a private club can stop whoever they want from coming in. Public schools can't necessarily do that. That's all. But they've asked them to come forward and show because they have been brought up in this court case and they're going to need to be able to show why, how it is that they choose their students.
If they're able to demonstrate that what they do and why they do it is defensible, is that okay? Like if they say, like, if we did let this many people in, then all these other minorities or other ethnicities wouldn't be allowed, wouldn't have the same opportunity because.
Well, I think you have to say, well, how much. Because what they'll say, and it went to the Supreme Court, it can be race can be a contributing factor. Overall, we want to make sure that we have a diverse student body. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, we're not going to necessarily have quotas, but we will take into consideration. And then they say, well, how much into consideration?
Yeah,
is it going to be an 8? Is it a 15? Is it a 50? Is it a 100? What's the consideration? And they won't tell you what that number is. Mm-hmm. And I understand, and Tom would argue that it's important to have a diverse student body. I got that. But it seems like we're going to discriminate against one group in order to let another group in. And then there's that whole story of you let somebody in who was not necessarily the best student in order to be able to have a diverse student body, and that person fails out after a mm-hmm. year and a half, and you've wasted that spot on somebody who really didn't earn that spot in the first place.
Interesting to see what happens. Yeah, it's...
yeah, there we go. Let's bring Danny back in. You can keep talking to him. Well, you're supposed to write your obituary in order to have your next career move. So you're basically saying how you passed away on the one job and then left that, and then you move on to your next job.
You know, I find that when I fill in on this show, it effectively functions as a professional obituary for my other projects.
Plus, also, a guy passed away, and his family decided that they would write a wonderful obituary for him. Unfortunately, none of it was true. And, of course, it got picked up by social media talking about what a brilliant life this man had lived.
Great example for all of us.
All righty. You can text us the Online Trading Academy text line 98973. Be a big part of the show. Tom was taking his mother over to visit his dad's gravesite. And the mom started to fall. Tom went to save his mom and then, in an attempt not to fall himself, slipped on some loose sod and tore his muscle in his thigh asunder. And now he is ailing, and tomorrow we find out whether or not he needs surgery. And Felix, who's filling in, doing a fine job, and also sort of taking Tom to task that it's your leg, it's not your mouth, why don't you get in here?
Yeah, I mean, wheel in, whatever it takes. Call a cabulance. Take a couple more Advil.
Come on, some sympathy for him.
You could lay on the floor right here. This microphone, I tested it during the break.
Yes.
The microphone stretches down far enough where if he just held his neck up maybe an inch, he could talk right into it. No one would know the difference.
For 3 hours.
Easily, yeah.
All right. Well, and until that time, a series of co-hosts come through here. Like tourists in Amsterdam. Let's see.
You have people on standby is what you're saying.
That's
ready
exactly what's happening.
On a moment's notice.
Here's a couple of stories for you. Let's start with the fact that you write your own obituary before planning your next career move. Here's what they mean by that. There's this thing called reverse career engineering. And probably the greatest example that's ever given of this is if you want to be president of the United States, become a governor. Prior to becoming a governor, serve in the House, in the legislature, in your state, either as a senator or and in the House of the state. And then prior to that, just working your way down, be a city council member. And mm-hmm. prior to city council, serve on the planning commission. And prior to that, do some volunteer work. And then prior to that, you're supposed to then work sign up for Rotary. And a friend of mine that walked through this program said to me, so what you now need to do is you then say, who can I call in the next 30 seconds that will begin this process for me? And the reason they use the president position in such an interesting way is you can easily follow the steps to become president of the United States, because that's how most people end up. You know, it's not like go around and have sex with a bunch of Playboy centerfolds and then get yourself a reality television show. That was slightly different. But
hey,
in this case,
you write your own obituary, however you want to do it. Okay,
right.
Whatever the steps you identify, that will reverse engineer your way to the top.
So how does rewriting your obituary get you the next career?
Well, it's this whole notion of envisioning something and then working toward it. There's a piece by Miki Mikitani. He's the head of Rakuten, which is this big Japanese company. I'm probably mispronouncing it. But after witnessing his aunt and uncle die in the big earthquake back in 1995, he realized life is short. We all have a limited amount of time here on Earth. So I'm going to think backward. I'm going to envision where I want to be, you know, CEO, billion-dollar CEO of a company, and I'm just going to start building my company right now. This was big in the 90s. Remember this Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Successful People?
Yeah.
One of the first exercises in that book, which I remember really turned me off of that. I only got through one of the habits, I think. Obviously, I mean, look at me.
Look at you.
It was writing your obituary, what people would say about you at your funeral,
yeah,
which seemed really narcissistic to me. I mean, who cares what they say at your funeral? Because you're dead.
Well, Jeff Pinio, my friend who used to be the president of Horizon, told me, it's not your obituary. You're writing your eulogy. It's what you hope people would be saying about you at the time of your death. So if the person got up there and said, you know, Felix was a great guy. He always put other people first. I remember one time I called him. It was the middle of the night, and he got in the car and drove out and had sandwiches for me and my family, and it was just an amazing. He's one of those guys who was always thinking of others. And if that's what you want written down, mm-hmm. if that's what you want people to say, then you better start driving around delivering sandwiches in the middle of the night or whatever else it is you're supposed to do. Don't just say, well, I want to be well-remembered. Do things in order for you to be well-remembered. That's what I think Covey meant in that first one that you ended up not doing.
I guess that makes sense to aspire to something. And this, what Miki Mikitani says, it's pretty simple. He just says, you know, work backward from death. There's no secret steps here. It's just envision what that is and think logically what each of those jobs would have been to your top job. What was the job right before it? Just like you said, whether it's president or whether it's CEO or whether it's having your own company or like my dream of being a dog groomer.
Wow. All right. That's quite the dream.
I always get that on those career tests. You always get dog groomer comes up. I don't know why that is. It's because I like working with animals and I don't want to go to meetings and don't want to. I don't know why that is.
So what's stopping you from becoming a dog groomer?
I don't want to be a dog groomer. It's just the test always says I want to be a dog groomer, and it's inaccurate.
The Wilmington man who led a fairly unremarkable life gets an opportunity to shine at his death.
Yeah, this is a guy named Rick Stein. He died from cancer, it turns out, very recently. And this was taking the internet by storm last week about this obituary that really shows this guy led an interesting, exciting life. And it all turns out that his daughter wrote the whole thing, as she'd done for a relative earlier, just as kind of a family in joke. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they thought it would get picked up by social media. It was on that legacy.com where I wrote my mother's obituary last December, and you know it appeared on there. I don't think it went viral. But they said, so they had some great lines in it where they quoted his brother. Stein's brother, Jim, echoed similar confusion. Rick and I owned Stuart Kingston Galleries together. He was a jeweler and oriental rug dealer, not a pilot. Meanwhile, Missy Ledington of Charlottesville claimed her brother was a cartoonist and freelance television critic for The New Yorker. So these sort of fabrications pile and pile upon each other. And I saw it last week, and I just thought, wow, interesting guy. It never did cross my mind that it was fake. I mean, why would somebody fake their father's obituary? It seemed kind of, again, it never crossed my mind. I was spoon-fed it as social media and just swallowed it hook, line, and sinker.
And I guess the dad of... Not seeing it in the article, probably thought it was enjoyable that the family got an opportunity at his death in order to make something up and fool everybody.
Yeah, and the best part of it is the opening of it where it talks about he's this 71-year-old guy who left his hospital room. He was suffering from cancer, but he escaped in the middle of the night, and the NTSB said, well, we just know he must have headed out to sea. We don't know where the plane crashed, where it landed, but you know, he's gone. I believe that part.
Mike Roman will be well known. He hasn't died yet, but he's trying to kill himself by eating pizza every single day of his life.
I think my mom gave in, and every time I said I don't want this or I don't want that, she's like, okay, you don't have to have that. So it must have, because I really don't remember that far back how I ended up eating pizza every day, but that must have been the way it happened.
He was 4 years old when he first showed these picky eating habits, and his mother let him eat pizza for dinner every night since he was four. Mm-hmm. He's 41 now.
Here he is talking about what he ate in high school.
What the hell did you eat at school?
Peanut butter. I used to bring my own.
So, okay, so this is the trick. Your lunch is peanut butter every day, and your go-to for dinner is pizza pretty much religiously.
Yeah, peanut butter every day. Even in grade school, I go home for lunch, and my mom would make me peanut butter. She put a heart in it. But then I would go to...
Why is this guy on the news? Why are we playing this?
Are there locusts in the background? I hear like a plague of locusts.
It's not really news. This is just a podcast that he got interviewed for.
Oh, okay. So he's eating pizza every day. Yeah. Oh, all right. Yeah, let's get him on.
There's times where like, you know...
Yeah. I act like I'm with him. Hold on.
There's times where like, you know...
Yeah.
If you're in a serious relationship...
Uh-huh.
And, you know, you're dating someone for years, and you say you can get whatever you want,
sure.
I'll get what I want. We come back to the house for pickup or,
you know,
whatever. we never really had a, like a date at a fancy restaurant where I just sat there and didn't eat.
Right, that's
she
what
wanted
she said.
To have something specific.
Yeah.
But either way, you still like the pizza. There's another deviation, right?
No. Yeah, we would go to a place that would have pizza.
Okay.
Here's some other interesting fun factoids about this guy.
I don't care.
He works as a teacher. No. He works as a teacher. And guess what his favorite kind of pizza is? Plain. Cheese, no toppings. They also, if you look this up online, he lists his favorite restaurants in the Hackensack area. So it's news you can use.
Talking about people that were eating things that were strange, or at least things you shouldn't eat every single day. Stephen Miller, who works for the president, who writes a lot of his international sort of policy speeches. Miller's third grade teacher, who's now 70 years old, has been put on sort of temporary reassignment. She says she's working from home. I don't know what that means.
She's on home assignment, they call it.
Yeah. Because 20 or 30 years ago, she had Stephen Miller in her class, and she was a third grade teacher. She talked about the fact that Miller used to take Elmer's glue, put it all over his hands, and then allow it to dry, which most people did, or a lot of people did, and then he would peel it off. And normally, he would just show the person sitting next to you your fingerprints. He would do what with the glue?
He would eat it. Eat the dry, chewy Elmer's glue, which, you know, it's weird. I know what it tastes like. I can remember what Elmer's glue tastes like. I never ate it dry. I always ate it when it was damp, kind of licking it off my fingers if it was stuck on your hands or glue and stuff. Like if you're making your Christmas wish book thing, right?
Yeah.
So now this poor teacher, though, I mean, all she did, she commented to the media about her former student. What's wrong with that? She called him a strange dude. And they put her on suspension.
Because she's a teacher, and he's in third grade, and she's taking shots at him now because she doesn't like Trump, so she decides she's going to be this activist who's going to go after a third grader who liked to eat glue.
Trump's not mentioned anywhere in this. Oh, wait, he is. He mentioned because Stephen Miller works for Trump, senior aide.
I had a girl next to me, or a boy next to me, who used to take rubber cement.
Oh,
pull his tongue out, and then with that weird, like, metal brush, brush it onto his tongue.
Oh, geez. That is nasty stuff. That is cool. I don't want to talk about the rubber. I remember.
I'm kidding, Jacob.
I want to tell you one thing, though.
It's going to be in his obituary, though.
When I was in high school, there was one of those big one-gallon cans of that Carter's rubber cement.
Yeah.
And around the lid of it, there was lipstick around the lid of it.
Okay. All right.
Not going to fill in the blanks.
All right, we still don't have a sponsor for this mailbag. What's going on? No. So let's, out of historic purposes, head on down to the Twin TVs right off Aurora Avenue and have a fabulous time with your family at Twin TVs. That's Twin TVs right off Aurora Avenue. There's no internet address because it's Twin TVs no longer there. Here comes the mailman now. Remember the Twin TVs?
Oh, yeah, I love the Twin TVs.
I'm the mailman. As you can see, I'm the mailman. Don't nobody mess with me. I'm the mailman. If you didn't know, I'm the mailman. I bring the mail to your door.
Yes, he does. And there's a teeny tiny lady who lives in a pickle jar. Hello to you.
Hello.
She rolled in with Charlton Heston earlier today.
Yeah.
He was screaming and yelling.
The jar was bouncing around. I was worried it was going to shatter.
We're going to get the letter of the day, but first let's get started with all the others.
This is for me filling in. From area code 253, Felix, we love that walk-in tune, Good Child Memories. Happy Monday morning to the team that entertains and informs.
That's our job. 206, Felix is doing a great job, and so good to hear him on with John.
Thanks. From the 253, just going to say this. Mm-hmm. If Dory can do his show from London, then Tom can do this show, especially from his living room or bathroom, LOL.
Mm-hmm. 360, I want to challenge Tom to come up with letter of the day. Let's see if he can beat that Red Sox lover or garbage driver.
How
dismissive on Joey the Garbage Man. Go ahead.
About your hiking adventure, area code 360 says, go hike Rattlesnake Lake Trail. Great view, and nobody will shush you.
Yeah, the shushing from the guy. And I kind of looked at him, I judged him, because that's what you're supposed to do. And then to have him shush me just turned me off on the whole hiking thing. Millennial in the basement, 425, Eric says, Eric in the 425, the basement steps that John walks down to speak with Andrew sound really old. I think we need Felix Benow to go down there and see if he can find any historic relics.
Very nice. And on the whole stick shift controversy, 206 says, I'm a 39-year-old woman and I can check off everything, every item in that How to Be a Man column. Mm-hmm. Also, my parents would not let me get my driver's license until I learned how to drive a stick shift.
My mom, by the way, I should say that all the things that she mentioned, tie a bow tie, fire a rifle, ride a horse, and a stick shift. They all had to be done simultaneously. 206, rent a car in Europe, no choice, you get a stick shift.
Ain't that the truth? Sandy in Olympia says, learning how to drive a stick shift could be easier if the student first sees an actual transmission and its working parts to learn what gears and cogs actually look like and how they make a machine go. I learned it, but I'm still a horrible driver.
Oh, okay. So apparently that doesn't work.
Nice idea, though.
Animal Stories 360. Jacob, I have an awesome animal story. Even John will like, especially because it seems that someday it helps his memory. You can find it on a podcast called Radiolab about memory. It's about old mice in mazes not being able to remember the maze. But if their blood is replaced by younger mice blood, shazam, kind of like vampires staying young except for real. And for the record, your music choices are awesome, Andrew.
Very nice. And regarding Sears declaring bankruptcy, Allegra and Olympia says Sears management was idiotic and their catalog department in the early mid-1990s, just as the internet was beginning to gear up and change retail. Uh-huh. Sad end to a historical company, in my opinion.
253 writes, born in the mid-60s. Well, this is right in my generation here. I grew up with a Sears and Roebuck Montgomery Ward catalog and all the joys of the Christmas catalog. At four or five, my wishes include the Lionel Train set, maybe an additional Lincoln Log collection, and, as always, the battery-operated King size red Corvette. Then a few years passed, and as my wish list changed, it morphed into more towards that mysterious section, women's underwear. And with great care not to crease a page or open the catalog too far, therefore leaving a telltale sign of my perusing, a young boy, eyes wide, would flip through page to page. Ah, sweet memories.
Regarding Elizabeth Warren's DNA test, okay, close the wish book, please. Eric in Bothell says, I have a picture of my maternal grandmother, great-grandmother, great-great-grandmother, and mother all in the same picture circa 1920. There's no doubt because of the photo that I am the descendant of Native Americans. Mm-hmm. My paternal grandmother wanted nothing to do with us for that reason. Her son married a Native woman, which I learned at about age 18. I had a DNA test last fall, and I discovered I'm about 2% Native American, not the 16 to 32% I expected. Mm. My previous belief was wrong, but not a lie. I suspect Elizabeth may also be living under incorrect assumptions. It doesn't mean she's lying.
Ah, thank you. Eric in Bothell once made famous by the show. Carrie, not Carrie, in Sumner.
I think it's Carrie, not Carrie.
I was going to say, because that doesn't make any sense. I am one of the many Coug residents.
Could just be about the spelling, though. You never know.
Again, I'm not big with names.
Hey.
Let's see. I am one of the many Coug residents in Western Washington and is thrilled that game day appearance will be coming to Pullman this Saturday. We are season ticket holders and we'll be there to enjoy the thrill of the unprecedented event. Some folks on talk radio make Coug Husky rivalry fun and lighthearted. Others are just petty and childish. I'm sorry to discover today that Danny O'Neill is unfortunately the latter. The flag jokes weak.
Ouch. Okay. Regarding the president on 60 Minutes, 425 says, I'm president and you're not. Best quote since I'm the decider.
And 253, John, just because you don't take moral guidance from the president doesn't mean other people don't. The bigots and misogynists among us see the president behaving that way and they say that it speaks for them. Okay?
And now it is time for the letter of the day.
Letter of the day.
This is from Larry in West Seattle.
Oh, good.
Let's closely examine leaving your Porsche to the kids. This is about you, John. Mm-hmm. It has no wipers for the rain. You have to run over the speed bumps to get the radio to work. It's been stopped numerous times for speeding, flipping the bird to toll cams, violating carpool lanes, and recently set a Northwest stink eye record while broke down on the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Its fuel consumption is just under a Panzer Mark IV, and ensuring it cost an arm and a leg.
Yes.
Your kids are holding out for a self-flying, electric-powered Blingmobile with rack for urine bags. That will set Dad back enough to have to stop investing in the Botox, naturally growing hair implants, and nipple-enhancing therapy.
Okay. I would just correct on one thing. Nipple-enhancing therapy.
That's not coming soon.
Out of time. Bye-bye.